So if you've been paying attention to our radio show here for a while, and also to how upside down America is during the crisis of our time, it feels like all of this was foretold politically by the 2000 election when George Bush was able to beat Al Gore. And as part of the storytelling around this and the fortune telling around it, Billy Corbin, the director of Cocaine Cowboys and The U, and he does a lot of fun stuff, a lot of creative stuff. He decided to tell this story about how batshit crazy Miamians are, Cubans in Miami are. And you see, as Jorge Masvidal sits here and ends up campaigning with Donald Trump, and as among Cubans, Donald Trump's Q rating is the only group, Cubans are the only group with which his Q rating has improved. And if you're looking to have some of that explained, Billy Corbin does so in a documentary that debuts this week on HBO. It is 537 votes. The filmmaker is interesting on all subjects, but I wanted to talk to him specifically about the foreshadowing and the fortune telling in the 2000 election. Again, that movie debuts this week on HBO, and after that, you can get it whenever you want on the corresponding HBO apps. But let's talk to Billy Corbin here about his movie. One of the things that fascinated me, Billy, about Mitch Albom's writing career out of Detroit is that he mined Detroit for all of these amazing stories, and he was able to go into some places as a journalist that normally the rest of America doesn't get to see. You have had such success mining the Miami stuff, and here you are on HBO now presenting to the United States on a signature platform how weird and wacky and batshit crazy Miami is, and how much it has to do with where we are in 2020, specifically because of how this election went awry, 20 years ago, with Miami at the forefront with Elian Gonzalez. So what led you to this particular story? Why did you want to tell this one?
We always say the Miami of today is the America of tomorrow. And if you want to know what challenges we'll face or calamities will befall us as a nation in the years to come or decades to come, you need only look at South Florida. We are just the, as T.D. Allman called us, the city of the future, America's bellwether, the proverbial canary in the coal mine. And when I think about that phrase, the Miami of today is the America of tomorrow, I tend to think about 2 years in particular, which are 1980 and 2000. And obviously those are 20 years apart. And now we are now 20 years into the future in 2020. And last year, we were sitting around the office, my producing partners, Alfred Spellman, David Sipkin, and I, and talking about the election, the national election next year, meaning this year, 2020, and what we might do to get involved or do a project that would focus on that. And we were aware that there'd be a glut of product in the marketplace that would be 2020-centric, you know, that would focus on the cast of characters involved in contemporary politics, and thought that, you know, maybe we should do something a little bit different. And as a lot of things in our industry, buyers tend to be fixated amongst other things on anniversaries, meaning why are we telling this now? Why now? Why do a story about the 2000 election? Well, it's the 20th anniversary, so there's good cause to look back. But also because I think so many of the events that occurred in Miami, socially, politically, culturally, are now on the fore of a conversation. It seems like these fault lines initially break in Miami and then kind of spread outward from there. We kind of export this Florida f***ery and this Miami madness. And so this just seemed particularly relevant in light of the fact that, you know, our assistant at the time last year, last summer, 2019, when we're having this conversation, she was born in 1990. And so she was 10 when the 2000 Florida recount shenanigans went down. And we asked her, what do you remember about the 2000 recount? And she kind of shrugged sheepishly and then said, hanging chads? Was that a thing? And we're like, yeah. So she had some reference, but that was the extent of it. Nor did she know what what that meant, what hanging chads were. And so we wondered how many Americans were born between 1990, when she was born, and too young to really remember the Florida recount, and 2002, which would mean that you weren't born yet for the recount, but you would be theoretically eligible to vote in the election in 2020. How many Americans were born in that period, 1990 to 2002? And the answer is 54 million Americans, approximately, have no idea how the first election, national election, of this millennium went down, and how 537 votes in Florida swung the outcome and the fate of the free world.
One of the things I believe the best documentaries do, beyond teaching you stuff like that where you learn, is putting things in a proper context so you understand just how insane this story is. Your movie is funny, and it's also infuriating, as you know, California catches fire and Al Gore is the climate change guy, that it is. You watch your movie and I'm wondering the spots where you get enraged, as someone in Miami who's an activist, as someone in Miami who's always calling bullshit on politicians. Like, I got to imagine, not only was this fertile soil, it had to enrage you, everything that happened there.
Well, you've opened up a lot of cans with a lot of worms in them. I'll say that, yes, tonally, we wanted to approach this very similarly to how we kind of in a way approach everything, but mostly some of our more recent work, like Screwball, about A-Rod and the biogenesis steroid scandal on Netflix, which was in a kind of tongue-in-cheek, almost satirical fashion, as a heist movie. And that's really what Screwball was. Screwball was like a sports heist movie. It was also what we like to call a butterfly effect story, where a very kind of small, seemingly insignificant group of characters kind of shape the greater world. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings in in Africa, and you know, language changes over time, or the future is forever altered. And that's the thing in Screwball. The shtick there is that, like, it's how, you know, the $400 million man, the highest paid baseball player in history, his career ended over a $4,000 debt between a cocaine addicted fake doctor and his fake tan addicted steroid patient. And like how that seemingly trivial events impacted a very big thing like Major League Baseball. And so it's kind of like that here. It's like how this small group of kind of Miami political grifters responding in no small part to this call for voto castigo, the revenge vote, in the wake of the Elian Gonzalez fiasco, changed the fate of this country. And we didn't want to get, so we knew we wanted it to be this political heist movie in the way that Screwball was a sports heist movie. And tonally, we wanted to kind of have our tongue in cheek, make it, you know, Carl Hiaasen or Elmore Leonard or Dave Barry-esque. But obviously we're dealing with an issue of great consequence and a very serious election at that. And so we wanted to draw all the parallels that you are seeing and that you are finding. And we wanted to do that in not an overt way, where we didn't want to necessarily show you images or B-roll or news archive of what's happening in 2020. We wanted the audience to make those connections for themselves. And needless to say, all of those are in there intentionally. We hope that like you did, the audience will pick up on all of the contemporary parallels to 2000 and to 2020. And needless to say, they are infuriating, you know, and not the least of which is, I often say, the Democrats never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And I think there's a lot of lessons in how they handled and mishandled the 2000 election that you hope that they've learned. But as you watch them conduct themselves over the last 4 years, you fear that they have not.
I didn't want to see Roger Stone in this movie. When I saw Roger Stone in this movie, it made me think of you needing to bathe after doing that interview. And you have interviewed some unctuous characters over time. So how did you experience that part? And I'm just talking about A-Rod here. How did you experience the whole just greasiness of all of this?
That's a really good question. And a good point, too, is that we talk to people on both sides of the aisle. This is not a particularly partisan venture, despite my being very open about my politics. I think it was important to hear from Republicans and Democrats alike in order to have the first person perspective that we needed, but also so that the audience could glean as many lessons as I felt were necessary to get from this story. And so, yes, we interviewed Roger Stone. We interviewed Brad Blakeman. So Roger Stone was an unofficial operative of the Bush campaign in 2000. Brad Blakeman was an official operative of the Bush campaign in 2000. We also interviewed Al Cardenas, who was the Florida, the chair of the Florida Republicans at the time. And there's a lot of interesting perspectives from the left and the right. And I mean, I think in interviewing everybody, I mean, certainly like I was very candid about, like, I think the Democrats had quite a few shortcomings when it came to this election and recent elections in terms of their performance, in terms of their tactics, in terms of them not really understanding. I mean, they're not even in the same arena, let alone playing the same game that the Republicans are playing. And that's really the lesson here. So I was pretty hard and pretty pissed at the Democrats that I interviewed as well. I mean, the Republicans did some shady shit, but they were playing to win. The Democrats were so worried about doing the right thing that they lost sight of the ultimate goal. And now I'm not suggesting that they should do whatever they need to win, but I'm suggesting that that's what the Republicans did. And Brad Blakeman, the Republican political operative who worked on the Bush-Cheney campaign, said it was the recount in Florida was a three-legged stool. You had to win in the courts, you had to win in the recount rooms, and you had to win on the streets. And Al Gore's stool was missing that third leg, and thus it fell. Because it wasn't enough to just get more votes, which Al Gore did. He got more votes than George Bush did. You also had to fight to have your votes counted and to have your votes counted properly and to ensure that there was integrity and transparency and democracy in this system.
Which there wasn't, right, Billy? I mean, which there was not. Those votes were not counted, period.
No, and it's worse than we even get into in the movie, because we're kind of focusing, you know, the movie 537 votes is about 1 year in the life of Miami-Dade County, starting in November of 1999, about Thanksgiving, when Elian Gonzalez is found floating on an inner tube off the coast, and takes us all the way through December of 2000, where the 2000 election ended, which was almost at Christmas time. Just to give your listeners a sneak preview of what we might be experiencing this year, the 2000 election did not end until almost Christmas, when, you know, days earlier, when the Supreme Court ultimately decided. So there's a lot of issues and a lot of things that happened down here that are still happening to this day in Florida, whether it's gerrymandering that essentially ensures that despite the fact that there are more registered Democrats in Florida than Republicans, the Republicans still manage to control the state based on gerrymandering and ensuring that Republicans can control a majority of power, whether it's disenfranchisement of voters through either making vote by mail more difficult, by reducing the polling places and locations, whether it's purging felons from the voter rolls, sometimes improperly and unjustly, which disproportionately impacts African-American voters who tend to vote Democrat. So this is all by design. When you don't have the demographics on your side to win fairly, you have no choice but to cheat and to rig the system. And then, of course, the best defense of that is to point the finger at the other side and accuse them of doing exactly what it is that you're doing. And that's been happening for decades, and the Republicans are experts at it because they just don't have the numbers. You can see, I mean, Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000 by over 500,000 votes. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016 by over 3 million votes. So you can see the numbers are not on the Republican side, but yet they continue to manage to retain power through the most nefarious ways, as seen in this documentary.
All of it seems crazy because I'm watching this and again, and having lived it, I can't even imagine what this is like for the people of the age that you're talking about who don't even know, for example, the Ilian Gonzalez story. So for those who are listening right now, how would you explain it to the uninitiated who right now are saying, yeah, I know something about a little boy on a raft, but tell me more about that story? Because there was parts of the movie there, Billy, that were heartbreaking for me as a Cuban American, because it just reminded me of how lonely I felt through that time trying to explain to America why that kid shouldn't go back to his father in Cuba.
You know, I don't know that I can explain it. I'm glad that you're here so you can help me. And I say that because people, you remember nationally, people understood it completely differently if you were not in Miami, and particularly if you were not a Cuban American or a Cuban exile in Miami. There was a completely different perspective on that story. And what happened was is that a group of, I believe about 10 people made the treacherous journey in a rickety boat from Cuba to the United States through shark-infested waters on an unsafe watercraft, and the boat sank. And everyone aboard, except for I think about 3 or 4 people, perished at sea. And one of the survivors was a 5-year-old boy named Ilian Gonzalez, whose mother was among those who drowned. And he was found on an inner tube. I don't know how they managed to get him onto this inner tube, but he floated for days at sea and was discovered by 2 fishermen, just, you know, not even professional fishermen, just sort of, you know, recreational fishermen who were out on Thanksgiving morning and found this 5-year-old boy on this inner tube, literally just this black rubber inner tube that said "Made in the USSR" etched in it, and it really became this huge international media story. It became a huge international custody battle. It really became a huge international arroz con mango. Is really what it became, which is, for those who are uninitiated, it's sort of Cuban slang for cluster. And it also
just rice and mangoes.
Also, yes, the literal translation. But the Ilian's father, who was alive and well in Cuba, wanted his son back. And he obviously was the closest surviving relative. Ilian had distant family in Miami known as the Miami Relatives, which actually became such a pop culture term, the Miami Relatives, that in the 3rd season of The Sopranos, there was a fictitious band at the strip club named the Miami Relatives in honor of this story.
Cuban Americans know that. Cuban Americans absolutely know the idea. I mean, our entire city's built on the Miami Relatives taking us in.
Absolutely. And so these were distant relatives who wanted Ilian to stay, obviously, in the United States in freedom. And not only did this become a huge local issue, obviously, for obvious reasons, which is that, of course, by the mid-1990s, Cuban Americans were the minority majority in Dade County. They were in control of virtually every lever of power in both the public and private sectors, in every municipality, in every bureaucracy, in every municipality. Was run and controlled by Cuban Americans. And so this issue was huge locally, but then it became a major issue nationally. And then, of course, internationally, because Fidel Castro was demanding that the boy be returned to his father in Cuba, which is a pretty extraordinary and emotional situation when the tyrant that so many thousands of people risked their lives and separated from their families to flee is demanding this child back. It was an incredibly traumatizing event for this community. But what was most, I think, almost, I don't want to use a trivial term, but is almost quaint or charming, is that all of these national Republican figures, Anglos, we're suddenly so concerned about the welfare of this 1 5-year-old immigrant child when you can't get a Republican to care about thousands of immigrant children being separated from their parents and put in kiddie concentration camps by this government. Suddenly, one immigrant boy who came here illegally, they wanted to keep him in the United States and preserve him at all costs. And really, it was disingenuous. They were doing it for purely craven political reasons. And that was to put the Clinton administration in a presidential election year in a very awkward position, and particularly Al Gore, who was the vice president, who was the front runner for the Democratic nomination for president, to put him in the awkward situation of kind of, you know, having him hamstrung with this Elian Gonzalez issue, because it was very clear how it was going to go. Once the feds got involved, that obviously the United States was not going to be in a situation where a child was brought illegally to the country and the closest surviving parent wanted the child back, where the United States was not going to do that. Because you can imagine if the shoe was on the other foot, if some parent had brought their child to Cuba, for example, from Miami, and the other parent had died, and the parent in Miami was like, I want my child back, and Fidel Castro was like, we're not giving you your child back, that would be, I mean, people in Miami and in the United States would be in an absolute uproar over it. So the United States needed to be fair and needed to go through a process that was just, and they found ultimately that Elian belongs with his closest living relative, who is willing and able to take him into custody.
So for those of you who don't understand that, do you understand, Billy, in the telling of the story, or who didn't know all of that, how it is that Cubans in Miami would grow to feel so lonely when America, the country that they came to, simply didn't understand all of this and then took that boy out of the home of the Miami relatives by force? Did you learn anything in the doing of this that made you empathize even more with the Cuban position than you did, given that the Cuban position ended up fouling up the entire country, if where we are now with just climate change is something that concerns you?
I don't want to say that I have more empathy. I had a lot of empathy. And I think there's a lot of people in the United States government who had a lot of empathy. I think, but if you're going to be a nation of laws and you're going to respect the rule of law, when a federal court says that this is the just outcome, that the father should have custody, and then the family does not turn the boy over in accordance with our laws, and this goes on for weeks, where the attorney general herself, Janet Reno, who was for 15 years the state attorney, the lead prosecutor here in Miami-Dade, the attorney general of the United States comes down herself to personally spend hours negotiating with the Miami relatives, who were essentially, under the law at that point, kidnapping this child. This was a kidnapping in progress. And the attorney general herself, not through intermediaries, not through anyone beneath her, assistants, you know, U.S. attorneys, or she came down herself to try to negotiate this. Now, I want you to imagine if this were a Haitian child, Dan, do you think that there would have been months, weeks and months of this kind of patient negotiation?
No, of course. You used some great footage of Chappelle at the time, a very young Dave Chappelle pointing out correctly all the flaws in our country's rules when it comes to Cubans are allowed if they get a foot on land and Haitians got to go back. That's got to be infuriating to Black people.
And it is an immigration policy rooted in no logic or fairness other than the color of the skin of these immigrants. Economic refugee versus political refugee is a distinction without a difference, and it is a standard that is completely unfairly applied. And you know, we have to consider everybody individually and the merits of their plight and fleeing oppression and tyranny and crime and corruption. We need to give everyone an opportunity to have the opportunities that all of us have had.
Agreed, Billy. Agreed, obviously. Like, agreed, but you're just talking about letter of law, and that is the law in this country. It's why Cubans side with the Republicans, because Republicans protect that kid would, ostensibly, the idea is that freedom comes first. It's why Cubans side with the Republicans, even as I'm sitting here looking at Miami and being like, what the hell is going on in our city where Trump's approval rating has improved with Cubans and only Cubans since 2016?
A lot of the Cuban American and Spanish language media propagates the demagoguery of a communist boogeyman. But realistically, there is no communist threat to this country. There just isn't. You may see a kid at a Black Lives Matter protest wearing a Che Guevara shirt, and he may not, or she may not know what that means or who that person is or the harm that that person did to so many people. But that person is not going to overthrow the government. Okay. The greatest threat to our way of life or to democracy and to capitalism is actually right-wing extremism and fascism, and not some kind of fictitious communist threat.
It's actually an interesting form of privilege, Billy, because what you're talking about there, and it's how Cubans swing these elections, and it's how Cubans come by their viewpoint. They're treated differently than everyone else, and it feels like we kind of want to keep it that way.
Listen, Orlando wasn't the first bubble. We know about the Miami bubble, okay, down here. We know the Cubans call it the Miami bubble. And when you travel outside of the Miami bubble, you realize that there is not this, I call it Cuban supremacy. Cubans call it Cuban exceptionalism. There's actually a real term for it, but I call it Cuban supremacy because it's just like white supremacy, but within the Hispanic community. It's these people that we see in this extremist group down here are Cuban supremacists is what they are. And that manifests itself in many ways. But the second, you know, I hear it all the time from Cuban American friends, the second they travel outside of Miami, they get treated like Miami Mexicans. No one knows outside of Miami, no one knows the difference between a Cuban or a Puerto Rican or a Dominican or a Venezuelan. Everybody just paints Hispanics with the same brush, which is not fair. You live in Miami and you know you can't get into a road rage incident with someone until you see which flag is hanging from the rearview mirror. I mean, you got to know exactly where they're from to know whether or not maybe you should get out of your car. But that's the reality. Like in Miami, it's just Game of Thrones, you know, with iguanas instead of dragons. But like, you know, we have this very tribal kind of thing down here where we understand that, you know, Hispanics don't like to be called Hispanics. You like to be identified by your nation of origin, which I think is very prideful and wonderful. But when you travel outside of Miami, you know, people don't understand or respect the differences in Hispanic culture and don't really understand interseen Hispanic racism, which I think is a fascinating thing. You know,
it's your next documentary, Gringo. Let's stick to this one. Let's stick to this one for the moment, because I'm curious what you think is going to resonate from your documentary, because what I think, and no matter how smart I think it was, and no matter how I think it explains today without even doing much looking at today, I think the part that's going to resonate is a whole lot of people are going to learn something that they had no idea about. And whatever they think they thought they knew about how crazy it was, they don't have any idea of how crazy it was.
I think the most important thing is that, like, it's not like don't drink your juice in South Central. Like, there's not a message moment. You know, nobody kind of says like message or kind of hammers it at home in a very, you know, on the nose sort of way when you're learning something. I think it all comes in a very kind of brisk and entertaining kind of fashion. But I think there's a lot of lessons to glean from this. I certainly think that there's the history lesson element that you're talking about, where people will not only understand this history and get sort of this history reenacted, but they will understand it, as you said, even people who lived it will understand it in a new way or a different way, and get a new perspective on what actually happened on the ground here in Miami and how that, you know, changed the fate of the free world. I say that, not just the country, the fate of the free world.
No, it's shocking. It is completely shocking to see how clearly you lay out that everything that is happening in America right now, just about everything, can be foretold through this year and this prism.
My friend Fernando Mondi, who's a pollster and a political consultant, we interview him in the documentary. And one of the lines I didn't use of his is that, you know, he's been in politics his entire life. He's worked personally on 5 presidential campaigns. And whenever he's asked if you can name one election that you could go back in time and change the outcome of, what would it be? He does not skip a beat. 2000 every time. And interestingly, there was an episode of Family Guy. I tried to get these clips in the movie. It just didn't fit tonally in the epilogue because we were kind of beyond the comedy at that point. But there's this episode, Back to the Future inspired, where Peter goes back in time and then returns to the present and discovers that he didn't marry Lois. He didn't marry the wife. So and in this butterfly effect kind of way, not only is she married to like Quagmire and has kids with him, but somehow, as a result of them not getting married, Al Gore won the 2000 presidential election. It's just one of these butterfly effect quirks of changing the past. And there's this, and America is this like utopia where climate change has been dealt with, where there's no terrorism, we never went to war in Iraq. There's like all of these things that America is just this like incredible, peaceful, safe, wonderful place for your children. And there's a lot of truth in that comedy. And so I think that in addition to the history lesson, I think that there is inside this documentary a call to action. And it is, to be fair, a bipartisan call to action in many ways, because what it's saying is that you need to vote, that your vote counts, that the fact that the 2000 presidential election, the outcome of that national election, was the direct result of 537 votes in Florida, which is less than 10 votes per county. We have 67 counties, okay? None of us, the 2016 election, the outcome of that was 70,000 votes in three states. None of us know 70,000 people. I mean, that's not a lot of people statistically. That's nothing. I mean, it's less than a stadium or about a football stadium full of people. Maybe not at a Marlins game, but about a stadium full of people. But like 537, we all have more Facebook friends than that. Oh, all right. I was waiting for that. That was a little delayed, but but we all know 537 people. We can all reach out to 537 people and say, go vote. But the further lesson is that not only do you have to vote and does every vote matter and every vote counts, but you then may have to fight to have your vote counted. And I mean, I'm hoping that's the call to action ultimately in this, that people walk away from. And maybe, Democrats get a understand what went wrong, what their shortcomings were, and maybe they can learn to play the game, or at least, learn what game they're playing and in what stadium and arena they're in.
I am encouraging our audience, if they were confused, for example, by the conversation that we had on South Beach Sessions with Jorge Masvidal, how Masvidal could come by those opinions, or whether you think I'm a jackass for breaking free from some Cuban handcuffs in terms of how the thinking goes on this stuff. I would encourage you to watch this documentary so that you can arrive at your own conclusions at how Cubans become and became so insane. But one of the things in here, and we'll get you out on this, I don't think I've seen many depictions of cowardice bigger than how it is you portrayed Miami Mayor Alex Penelas. He did not sit for interviews. I would not blame him given how he's portrayed in this. How would you explain to the audience, why he wasn't in the movie talking to you after finishing third here recently and trying to resurrect his career, and what he did that would be so, inflammatory in terms of cowardice?
Well, Alex Penelas was the mayor of Miami-Dade County. He was the first Cuban-American mayor of Miami-Dade. And he was a bit of a political unicorn in that he was a Cuban-American Democrat, where most Cuban-Americans at the time, not all, but most, were traditionally Republican and very conservative, in fact. So he was really, he was the Democrats' Marco Rubio, or even really a Barack Obama kind of figure, where he could bridge the world between he was nationally, he was a minority, even though he was in the minority majority down here. But he could bridge that gap between Democrats and traditionally conservative Cuban Americans and really kind of bring everybody together. Everybody was, he was also named in November of 1999, People Magazine's sexiest politician. So there's also that. But they say the sky was the limit for him. He was rumored to have been on a list of potential running mates for Al Gore in the 2000 election, or maybe a cabinet position. He was the great Cuban hope, I think someone describes him as in the documentary. And he really also, as a surrogate to the Gore campaign, as the executive mayor of Miami-Dade, he was, and a Democrat at that, he was really supposed to help Gore make the inroads with the Cuban-American community in Miami-Dade County, and for them to understand and make clear that Gore did, in fact, break with his own administration, with the Clinton administration, and support measures to keep Elian Gonzalez in the United States. He was unsuccessful in persuading Bill Clinton or Janet Reno to take a different position, but they were attempting to follow the letter of federal immigration and custody law. So he was looking to Alex Penelas to help him. And in fact, Al Gore, his campaign and the national Democrats helped Alex Penelas get reelected in 2000 for precisely that purpose, that he could then be a lame duck, you know, have his, because he'd be term limited out after he was reelected, and that he could help proactively help the Gore campaign. And he ultimately, as one of Gore's friends and attorneys say in the documentary, left Al Gore at the altar and hung him out to dry every step of the way and in every conceivable way. When you realize that the entire presidential election came down to not just Florida, but Miami-Dade County, you realize how important, how crucial a role Alex Penelas could have had, and then abdicated that responsibility, basically out of sheer lust for power, betrayed his community, his party, and his country. And it's one of the sort of, I think, surprising and illuminating parts of this, because you expect it to be about Bush and Gore, and it's really about all of these really interesting and conflicted Miami characters. Because you have to remember, Al Gore lost Tennessee. That's his home state. There was the famous butterfly ballot where Jews voted for Pat Buchanan in Palm Beach, and 19,000 ballots got thrown out. There was the voter roll purges of African, particularly African-American voters who were unjustly kept from voting. There was other candidates on the, you know, third party candidates who siphoned tens of thousands of votes away from Al Gore. So the election was lost in many places, but it was stolen in Miami. And that's the particularly new take on this that 537 votes offers, but also why it's so relevant to what's going on in 2020.
Obviously stolen. Like, I think that you make the link strongly and the connections in a way that are indisputable. And I do think people should see the documentary as those who care about Miami show, a Miami show with Miami sensibilities, because Billy and Mike and Tony all understand everything Billy's talking about here. And it was fascinating to see Miami Cubans steal an election. And you're going to find a lot of stuff interesting about that. Billy, thank you as always for making the time. Always enjoy your work, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Go Canes.
Our thanks to Billy Corbin. We will talk more about that movie, I am sure, this week and beyond, because it is an interesting look into all things Miami. And if you're around this show and you know Mike and you care about Billy and Tony, you know that our story is through the generations. Cuban Miami story is something you've heard about plenty around here. If you want to support the stuff we are doing, LebitardAF.shop has a sale all month, 20% off. We've got a lot of new designs up there. Many of you rep our show in a way that is hugely flattering. So we don't do a lot of sales, but this month it's 20% off as part of what we were doing with Twitch and trying to give you guys a little more access here. So LebitardAF.shop, if you want some t-shirts, check that out. We'll talk to you next week.